You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 6th, 2012, and this is your host, Steve Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Buonasera, everyone.
Buonasera.
Hello.
How are you doing, Evan?
Just fine. Relaxed. Back from vacation and ready to go.
You'd rather be in Italy, though, right?
Yeah,
exotic. It was wonderful. It's a great time. Saw a lot of stuff. Vatican City, Pompeii, Isle of Capri. It was really great. Great time.
Well, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news after that nice vacation, but today's this day in science is kind of a downer because today, the day that we're recording this, June 6th, Ray Bradbury died at the age of 91.
That sucks.
How old was he?
He was 91 years old. So
whoa. 91 years young.
Yeah, at least you know, he had a good long life. We can be thankful for that. And he turned out a lot of great works in that time. And he got a lot of kudos. Our listeners are probably most familiar with his works like Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles. Oddly, he says Fahrenheit 451 was his only science fiction book. He had an interesting definition of science fiction. And so he always maintained that he was not a science fiction writer, even though they put that on all of his books. Greatest science fiction writer ever.
Wow. Sure, it helped sell a lot of those books, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, the Martian Chronicles, that's not science fiction? Come on.
Well, he says that it's fantasy because it couldn't actually happen. And he thinks that science fiction should just be about what could possibly happen.
Oh, I see.
So, yeah. Uh-huh. But, you know, that said, I think everyone will continue to remember him as one of the greatest science fiction writers ever.
And prolific. What, 50 full books and 600 short stories and essays? And that's all he did.
Yeah,
his short stories are my
favorite. I prefer his short stories to his longer works, personally.
Yeah, me too.
He's descendant of Mary Bradbury, who was she was found to be a witch during the Salem witch trial years.
Yeah.
And she was actually, you know, persecuted, arrested, but never, sentence was never carried out. They kept delaying it until she escaped. She made a getaway until the whole brouhaha with witches went away and she was able to, you know, expire on her own terms. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting. Never knew that before about him.
Wow. Indeed.
Another interesting Ray Bradbury fact. On Letters of Note today, they included a letter from Bradbury in which he discussed how he originally came to write Fahrenheit 451. He was trying to find office space and he was unable to find it anywhere. And so he happened to go past a university library and he heard the tick-tack of typewriters coming from down below. And he realized that in the basement of the library, they rented out typewriters for 10 cents an hour. So he gathered up all of his dimes, which amounted to about like less than $10. And he went down to the library basement and he sat down and he ended up writing Fahrenheit 451 in a couple of days, basically.
Whoa.
And
wow.
He wrote 25,000 words in just a few days. 9 days is how many days he says it took him. And it was the UCLA library, I should mention. And here's what he wrote in this letter. How could I have written so many words so quickly? It was because of the library. All of my friends, all of my loved ones were on the shelves above and shouted, yelled, and shrieked at me to be creative. So I ran up and down the stairs, finding books and quotes to put in my fireman novella. You can imagine how exciting it was to do a book about book burning in the very presence of the hundreds of my beloveds on the shelves. It was the perfect way to be creative. That's what the library does.
Wow.
Yeah, it's definitely a classic. I really enjoyed that book. But I could also see how he wrote it in 9 days.
What are you saying?
I get that. It makes sense.
You know, there's one big idea in that book. You know, it's cool. It's great. But, you know, you could just see that it was written that way.
Yeah, and I don't think it's his best work. Like I say, I much prefer his short stories. And I think that Fahrenheit 451, you know, it's a polemical novel, which is not necessarily going to be... It's good for being like the most well-read amongst, you know, junior high school students, and for good reason, but isn't necessarily the best read for adults.
Should we explain what typewriters are to people? I guess most good people point. Will know. No, most people should know.
Yeah, they can Google it.
But when he wrote that, there was no such thing as a print button.
Right.
Yeah.
He was kind of anti-technology, especially at the end. He felt there was too much internet, as he said, too much cell phone use. And he was, you know, he kind of felt it was taking away from our ability to really have meaningful conversations with each other. He was definitely an analog man, you know, and as years went on, he got stuck in the digital times. But, you know, he's a classic, no doubt about it. You had to admire him.
I think he said, didn't he say that there are too many internets? Isn't that his, his quote?
I think he did say that, yeah.
Well, that's pretty much the only way you could say that.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, he was a bit dystopian, I think, in his outlook on technology, because he saw technology as a way of distancing ourselves and of limiting human communication, when in fact, I think, you know, we would all agree that it actually does the opposite in a lot of ways. But he would see, you know, he mentioned once, I read a bit about him seeing a man and a woman walking along the street, and the woman had she was carrying like a little radio, and she had an earbud in her ear, and he was marveling at how, you know, the guy next to her might not have even existed. It didn't even matter, because she was listening to far off voices from a distant land. And to him, that signaled something really terrible, like this lack of connection with other people in the real world. But yeah, I think that he was a little short-sighted in that regard, a little too pessimistic.
Well, he was 91 in the end, you know, so we're talking several generations.
That's a that's a hard transition to make for people who live most of their life in the pre-digital age.
Yeah.
I think part of it is true. You know, we've all been in a situation where you've been with a family member or friends or whatever, and everyone's sitting there on their iPhone.
Yeah.
It's okay to admit that, you know, any big technological advancement doesn't necessarily mean it's an improvement on all, you know, all over the board. I mean, it's
right. But also I think you need to be not so quick to say that a change is automatically bad. Maybe it's not the end of the human race if we spend more time talking to people around the world instead of the people right in front of us. I don't know. It does annoy the shit out of me when people open up their cell phones at dinner, but
right.
Well, like Professor Farnsworth said, he said, technology isn't inherently evil. It's how it's used, like the death ray.
Exactly.
The death ray.
Well, today is another milestone, this one a very positive one. This is episode number 360. So if we are going to use arbitrary numbers as milestones for our show, we might as well choose one with a mathematical bent.
Yay, what a great idea.
The SGU, as they say, has come full circle.
Officially.
The history of the number 360 is actually pretty interesting. Do you know why there are 360 degrees in a circle?
I've heard it's because of the Babylonians, because they used to.
Nobody
60.
Really knows.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. There's no definitive answer. The Babylonians,
right.
That's one hypothesis. They used the sexagesimal system, a 60-based system.
What was that again? Woohoo.
Yeah.
Sexagesimal.
Sexy genital system.
Yeah. It's a base 60 numbering system, like a base 10.
Yeah.
Binaries, base 2. What they did was they would, when they were messing around with circles, they would use an equilateral triangle, and they would put it into a circle, and the two of the sides would be, the radius of the circle. And then if you took that and you divided it by 60, which they would naturally do because of their sexagesimal numeric system, then you'd have a degree. There's your 1 degree. So that could definitely have been definitely, you know, one of the main reasons why we use it. I mean, that's why they did it. But there's lots of other reasons, like one that is 360 is pretty damn close to 365 and a quarter days in a year. So that's another thing. That's another good reason. It's really close to that. And the other one that I think is probably one of the main reasons why it's stuck around is because 360 is so easily divisible. It's got 24 divisors. It's only one of the seven numbers that have more divisors than any number twice itself. Well, that's kind of kind of esoteric, but it's divisible by every number from 1 to 10, except 7. I mean, there's just so many different ways to chunk it up that I think that's one of the reasons why it stuck around so long.
Well, so is the other one, 60 itself. I mean, the sexagesimal system may have come about partly because 60 is divisible by so many numbers, including 1 through 6.
The other good one, get this one, the 24 time zones. Think about the 24 time zones. You divide them by 15 degrees of longitude, and there you've got your 24-hour, your 24 hours based, in different time zones separated by 15 degrees of longitude. So that's perfect. That really just kind of like meshes nicely. Yeah. So
I found this, and I'm just going to read this to you because I'm not good at math, and it takes me a long time to figure this what this actually means. So this is from mathforum.org. There's more to this than the six sixes for the 360 from the Babylonians. It has to do with Claudius Ptolemy, 100 to 170 AD, who divided the circle into 360 parts for his sine table. He actually used the length of the chord for each central angle in steps of half a degree in a circle of a radius of 60 rather than sines. I don't know what that means. No, but I thought I would offer it.
That's what Bob was saying. The chord is the base of the equilateral triangle, with the other two sides being the radii. And yeah, so there's six of them around a circle, and that gives you 360. Do you know what you call a unit smaller than a degree? If you have to divide a degree up, and Bob, you know.
Of course, Bob knows. Shut up, Bob.
You start with an arc minute. There are 60 arc minutes in 1 degree.
So it must be an arc
second. And there are 60 arc seconds in 1 arc minute. So that's 3,600 arc seconds in 1 degree.
Sweet.
So what would you do if you want more precision than that, Steve?
You do fractions of seconds.
Well, you do decimals.
Decimals of seconds.
Yeah. And then you could, and that's commonly done today. But in the past, some scientists would actually subdivide the arc second into pieces, into 60ths. And they would just denote that by using a Roman numeral like a 3 and then a 4. But that's, nobody really does that anymore. But it's just decimal versions of the arc second.
Right.
Hey, speaking of Roman numerals, the Roman numeral for 360 is CCCLX, right? So you got 5 letters there, 3 of which are the same, and 2 of them are different. Kind of like this show. We got 3 novellas, 3 C's. I'll be the L. And Rebecca, you can have the X.
I'm going to need 2.
I think so.
you're getting into some Bible code territory. This is interesting. We could develop a whole conspiracy theory of SGU and 360.
The numerology of 360.
There's actually this crazy person who, he hasn't emailed me in a while, but for the last few weeks, he's been really into me. If you go to etcorngods.com.
What?
That's etcorngods.com. It's this guy who thinks that, it's kind of sad because there's something seriously wrong with him. But he assigns numerical values to letters and then adds them together and, finds all of these different conspiracy theories and things like that.
Yeah, the Unabomber used to do that too.
Yeah.
Look where that wound up.
And I'm on his site. He decoded my name. And I'm sure if you email him, he'll decode yours as well.
So what does it mean?
Actually, I'm trying to find it right now. I might have deleted his crazy person emails. His name's George Simpson.
Simpson, eh?
Simpson.
I don't know if we should be talking about his name. E.T. Cornhole is another one.
Well, that reminds me of the Antichrist and Caesar Nero. And supposedly, if you use numerology, Caesar Nero equals 666. Is 666 is one of those theories, which is a coincidence because today
is June 6th.
Because June 6th, so 6 a.m. June 6th. That's the hour that Damien was born in the Omen, but from back in the 70s, the first release of the Omen. And for some reason, that just stuck with me, and I always remember that every June 6th. I mean, I might not be awake at 6 a.m., but I remember it on June 6th. Like, hey, today's 666 day.
Yeah, forget that it's D-Day, but it's Omen Day.
I found...
Antichrist Day.
I found what he wrote about me. It's actually on... Right. He has another blog called ufoetblog.com, and there he's translated my name. And you know, it's a long line of things, but it ends with...
Let me guess. Wait, your name translates into unicorn rainbow?
I wish. No, it's so much better, though. It's redheaded goddess wacko Miz, laugh at male ego.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Which is...
He needed a code?
I mean, yeah, I could have just told him, really. Although, I'm hesitant to tell him that my hair's not red anymore. It's blue, and I'm interested in seeing how that screws up his code. But anyway,
he's probably just reading it wrong.
We should probably let him know that this is our 360th show, and he'll probably find something.
Some significance.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Exactly what we want.
I could guarantee
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Rebecca.
No problem.
So did any of you guys see the transit of Venus on June 5th?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Boy, are my eyes are still burning.
Oh, yeah, baby. That was
What method did you use, Bob?
I found a telescope that I think Uncle Bob gave me like decades ago. Now, I was really upset because all day yesterday it was raining, it was overcast, and I was like, here's yet another astronomical event that's going to totally screw me because of the weather.
Yeah.
It just totally sucks. Like every year on Jay's birthday, the Perseid meteor showers.
Perseids.
Every year for the past 14 years, not just a couple years in a row, 14 years in a row, it's been overcast. And so I'm like, all right, I'm totally screwed again. But then I was driving home and the sun was peeking out between the clouds. I'm like, oh boy, I might actually have a chance. And keep in mind that it's like I'm within a half hour of the sun setting. So it's like time is of the essence. So I called my girlfriend Kate and said, get the telescope and get a piece of paper. And so I got home and I met her on the front lawn and she's trying to focus the image from the little tiny telescope. That's handheld. It's just the tube. It's really just a little foot-long tube telescope. But it did the job. She focused it onto a white piece of paper, and we're standing there trying to get it, waiting for the sun to poke out, and then focusing it on the paper. And at first we're like, oh, we can't see anything. And I had read that this was a very bad method to actually see Venus because it would be too blurry. But we saw this faintest brown speck near the edge. And I got so excited. I called Jay and his wife, Courtney, and they were upstairs. And they're like, Jay, you got minutes. Get down here right now if you want to see Venus. So they come running out. It was so funny. And so we're looking at it. And I'm taking some pictures with my phone, which are the worst pictures ever of Venus transiting the sun ever. Believe, I'll post it on Facebook. It is the lamest. But you could kind of see this like 2-pixel speck of shadow that is Venus.
I thought it was really cool, Bob.
It was awesome. Yeah, but Jay, then today I went online and I saw like professional pictures. Oh,
nope.
My God. Especially the
awesome stuff.
Especially the SDO, the Solar Dynamic Observatory images.
Well, I mean,
oh, my God.
Well, you can't compete with that.
I know. It's a spaceship. That's probably
But there
really
were
close.
I saw a lot of people got some really great images using the the pinhole.
Yeah, if you've got proper
like
equipment, it looked great.
Let me put it to you like this. There is no jankier way to do it than the way we did it, and it was still
Jay, I might
awesome.
Have beat you. I did it. I just held binoculars in my right hand and a white cardboard thing with my left hand
behind
out in
it.
Front, and I just focused the binoculars on the cardboard, and it worked perfectly fine. You get two images of the sun. You got to focus it just by moving, making the distance correct. It was bouncing around a little bit, but you could clearly see the black dot of Venus in front of the disk of the sun. It was awesome. But again, it was binoculars and
that's
cardboard.
That's pretty cool, Steve, but I think we had the jankiest,
well,
as Jay put it.
Let me tell you that one way that did not work was not having binoculars or a telescope. I went to our local science museum because they were having a little event, and it was by the time I got there it had sold out. But they were still, whoa, there was a sign that said that, we're sorry, it's sold out, but you can come inside. We'll give you a free pair of glasses so you can view it from the lawn. And so I went in to get the glasses, and they said that they were sold out of those too. They'd given away all of their glasses. But it was actually, it was kind of cool because the museum was just flooded with families that had turned out to see it. And you know, and like all, like just a really incredible diversity yeah. of families too. So it was really impressive that apparently like the schools and the local news and stuff did a good job of getting the word out that this was happening. And there were a lot of little kids that were super excited to see it.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity. I got, you know, one of my daughters with me at the time. She was totally excited to see this little speck on the brighter speck, you know, on the cardboard. Because yeah. yeah. I explained to her what it was.
Look at the
and
speck.
It was cool. They were very excited about it.
When you do stuff like this with Bob, like, he's amazingly excited. He's, like, bouncing up and down. He's like, oh, my God. Oh, look. Oh, awesome. Then randomly Bob's like, Jay, are you aware that this will never happen for another 125 years? You
know, yeah, it's only 105 years.
105, all right.
Yeah. No, you're both wrong. 105.5. And also, it also can – the length of time could be 121.5, but the next one will be 105.5. So December 11th, 2117.
Mark your calendar.
And I will get a much better picture for that one. And
in your hovering wheelchair, right? Look
no,
at
no,
that.
No, even better.
From your frozen tube.
If things go according to plan, I may be on Venus when it happens again. So that'd be
yeah.
really cool.
Wait, Bob. Now you've got to figure out – you got to figure out if there's anything else astronomical happening with the Earth at that point so we see some other thing looking at the Earth.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, right.
Bob, make sure you wave to us when you're there.
Oh, so I will. I'll shine a really bright, bright laser at the Earth so everyone looking at Venus will say, oh, that must be Bob.
Bob, remember you and I used to joke around a lot about in the future we would be able to communicate to each other just by making a beep noise?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was 2 weeks ago.
Like Bob and I'd be like walking to a room and I'd look at him and it would be like I'm just downloading every single thing that happened to me since the last moment I saw him. I'm transmitting it in a second. I would just look at him and go yeah. boop, like that.
Oh, God. Now I think Bradbury was right.
In a nanosecond. Yeah.
Ray Bradbury
you guys,
was right.
What do you guys know about the transit of Venus in 1882? Pretty exciting. 1882. There was one before that in 1874. So they typically occur in pairs. Then there was 1769 and 1761,
separated by 8 years.
Yeah, by 8 years. In 1882, that one was actually pretty momentous because that was the first time astronomers were able to calculate using geometry.
Wait, Steve.
Mm. Yeah,
I thought the same thing, and then I found other websites that said. 1762 was when they sent the ships out to precisely time the transit so that they could then infer or determine how far away Venus is, how far away the sun is, and then how big the solar system is. So I've actually got some discrepancy there. So
really?
I'm not sure if it was in the 1800s or if it was in the 1760s that actually happened. I've seen both cases.
No, I've seen multiple sources say that 1882 is when they measured the astronomical unit. But
yeah, that's the first one I read. But yeah, so I just want to prevent emails and stuff. But if you've read multiple,
yeah, but they could all be be deriving from the same source.
I know. The point was that that either from the 18th or 17th or the 18th or 19th century, they actually calculated that. Whoa, wait! With this Venus transit coming up, if we send ships to the four corners of the planet, like literally. And have them measure precisely as they could, of course, with the technology that they had. You know, when Venus, what's the term they use for when it breaches the outer limb of the sun? But if they could determine it, if they could actually time it, then they all got back together. They put all their calculations together. So then they were able to triangulate all these distances to the sun, to Venus, and then from there they could the size of the solar system. They actually came up with. Pretty much the modern conception or the modern determination of how far away the sun is. They said it's 93 to 97 million miles away. Well, yeah, that's damn close because it's like 93 on average. So that was a milestone. That was huge, huge.
Yeah.
Just based on the transit of Venus going in front of the sun. So that was a milestone.
Again, maybe everyone is just assuming it was the most recent one in 1882, but it was really one of the other recent ones. But in one of those previous transits of Venus was the first time that an atmosphere was observed around another planet.
Mm. Oh, very cool.
They were able to see it from the sun shining through.
Now, if you want to go a little further with that, have you guys heard about the Arc of Venus?
Yep.
Yeah, sure you have, Steve. This is really cool. In 2004, some scientist, some astronomer took an image of Venus. This is during the transit, the most recent transit before yesterday's in 2004, and he saw this weird semicircular arc of light rising above the atmosphere on Venus, and it was a lot of astronomers were like, what the hell is that? And this is a weird case of a minor mystery that could potentially solve an even greater Venus mystery with this most recent transit yesterday. I guess it was pretty quickly they found out that this arc of Venus was caused by refracted light when Venus is backlit by the sun. So it's just it's a basic atmospheric effect. But the interesting thing is that now that we know about this arc of Venus and what's causing it, we might be able to figure out this phenomenon of Venus called superrotation. Did you guys know? I wasn't quite aware of this. The entire atmosphere of Venus circles. Goes around 360 degrees of Venus every 4 days.
No.
Four Earth days. Now, just to put that into perspective, it happens on Earth every 243 days. So that's why they call it super rotation. We're not sure why. Why is it so fast? And the way this is related to this whole arc of Venus is that the arc is caused by refraction within that middle layer atmosphere of Venus called the mesosphere. And that mesosphere, it's causing the arc, and that mesosphere is actually, they think, a major player in the physics of superrotation. So if you know, the more you know about the arc of Venus, the more you know about the mesosphere, and the more you can learn about the superrotation and why it's happening and what exactly is going on. Now, back in 2004, they weren't ready to examine this arc. They weren't anticipating it, so they didn't really have everything set up to optimize, to really examine the hell out of this thing with the proper optics. Well, this year, yesterday, they did. They examined the hell out of it, and I have no idea what they found out, but when they do announce the findings about this arc of Venus, then we'll report it on the show, and we'll see what they learned.
All right, well, let's move on. So legislators in North Carolina are causing some more anti-science hubbub, although this one is not about evolution. It's about sea level rise. This is a classic case of legislators trying to meddle in the practice of science. So get this. The State House of North Carolina has proposed a bill that says that it has to do with on the effect of climate change on sea levels and therefore coastlines. And of course, that North Carolina has a lot invested in coastlines. And it includes this provision under Section 2. These rates, meaning the rates of sea level rise, shall only be determined using historical data, and these data shall be limited to the time period following the year 1900. Rates of sea level rise may be extrapolated linearly to estimate future rates of rise, but shall not include scenarios of accelerated rates of sea level rise.
What?
So they're writing the science.
Yeah, wow. So that's like pi is 3. You know, we're just going to decide that pi is 3, and that's the way it is. So they're saying
So
there's two things in there. It was 3, really. But the two big things are, one is that you can't use models or any kind of simulations or anything to predict sea level rise. You can't take into consideration what's actually happening in the world. You have to just extrapolate from historical data. And the second thing is that extrapolation has to be linear.
What the hell?
Right?
Why not just go with the consensus of scientists?
Because they don't like
know what they're
they
talking
don't
about.
Like what that
yeah,
says.
Yeah, they saw the consensus and they said, you know what?
We don't like that.
What we want. Yeah.
Because it's crazy. So it's partly because property values on the Outer Banks have a lot to do with predictions about whether or not they're going to be underwater in 50 years. And so they didn't want those pesky scientists saying that sea level rises are going to be obliterating their coastlines.
I think it's more than partially about that. I think it's almost entirely about that from what I've read. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the groups that are in favor of this bill are groups like the Business Alliance for a Sound Economy, which, and I quote from an article in Star News Online, represents the interests of home builders and developers in the Wilmington area. They opposed the use of accelerated sea level rise as a planning benchmark because they say that it could affect residential and commercial construction, piers, docks, public infrastructure, and other projects. And the thing is, they're specifically promoting this bill because it serves their short-term interests. And there are other people who are protesting the bill because they're in favor of science, and also because following the science will help with long-term interests, like, you know, Business Alliance for a Sound Economy claim they're, you know, looking out for public infrastructure. But the fact of the matter is, that's the thing that would be most affected if you ignore the science.
Right.
That's right.
When
they're hamstringing themselves, they're putting themselves in a bad position. Oh, well, we'll build here and do this, right? Based on this model of information. But instead, the actual models, real science models, will destroy whatever they build potentially, or, you know, give them all kinds of problems.
Right.
Also,
it's not
imply
just
that they're deliberately deciding that they just don't like the information, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's not just that they don't like it. It's that the information is economically disastrous for them.
Right.
You know, and so
they think so. I think that's.
Yeah.
I mean, the
thing is, it will have
totally
will have an economical impact, but that's in the short term. What they're worried about is, for instance, roads that adhere to what the science tells us sea levels are going to be doing will create a sort of barrier. They're going to be several feet above the ocean. So that's going to cost, first of all, a huge amount of money in raising up all the roads and any houses and anything else that's built. So that right there, yeah, will cause a huge economic impact. But in the long term, this sort of ordination determines where, for instance, you can build things like sewage treatment plants, and other things like that that have longer lifespans than, you know, just houses and hotels and things like that. So, you know, in the long term, yeah, this is actually going to protect us economically, assuming that that the scientists' projections are correct. What this bill is about is protecting short-term economic interests of local businesses.
Actually, guys, do you feel the same way I do? That makes me feel microscopically better than my first knee-jerk reaction to this, which was that these are just some anti-science yahoos, and that's their main motivation. They just don't trust science. They're anti-science. They believe in all this crazy stuff, and that was the first thing I thought. But now that it's purely
yeah, but it's so brazen. It's so brazen. I mean, dictating
it
methods
is.
Of science
right,
like that. The International Panel on Climate Change, you know, has put out a paper on projections of sea level rise over the next 100 years. They have different quote unquote scenarios, right? Different ways in which climate change can play out over the next 100 years and how things can interact with each other. And they're actually fairly conservative in that they are – most of the scenarios use like linear projections or extrapolations of glacial melt. So in a way, they actually already are being conservative in that way. And then even then, they come up with a range of 18 to 59 centimeters – sea level rise by the end of the century, of this century. But it's possible that there may be some game changers in there. You know, at some point, you know, this is not even considering something like, oh, you know, the Greenland ice sheet slips into the North Atlantic. That's not accounted for in any of these scenarios. It's just if the ice, the glacial melt continues at the same rate. So it could actually even be much, much worse, depending on variables that they're that you know, like a significant increase in the rate of glacial melt, which they're not including in that projection. So even with these conservative scenarios, it's still 18 to 59 is the range. But what the bill wants to do is to not even look at models of climate change or of how the climate works, you know. So and I don't know how they decided or how they justify saying this, that you can only use historical data and not models, and that the extrapolation should be linear. Why linear? That's completely arbitrary.
because they misunderstand. They don't have a clue.
Yeah, I mean, deciding how to extrapolate trends into the future is the whole game. And you know, when you're asking these types of questions.
See, I think they do have a clue, though. In a way, I think what they've done is someone has looked at the data and said, well, yeah, if you go by their data, this is what it's going to show. But if you just go linearly, then, you know, that gives us the result we want. So it's not just that they're ignorant of the science.
No, I said brazen. They're brazen.
I'm just saying it's not that, you know, Evan was saying that, you know, a lot of the implication is that they just don't know better, or that they don't know the science. But I think they may very well know the science, and they've, you know, but they've come up with a clever way, or what they think is a clever way, to ignore the science
and save their bottom line. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's it's just, temporary. But that's the whole thing that blows my mind, is like they're temporarily putting a Band-Aid on something that's just going to come back and bite them in the ass later.
Yeah,
on
but they won't
the
be
road.
In office when that happens.
Yeah, they're hoping that they'll be dead
right.
by then.
Plus, short-term thinking is, you know, like that, not surprising anymore.
Unfortunately.
But wait, we have more bad news about science in our culture. Evan, California is entertaining some ideas about science education that are not so good.
Yeah, not so good. Not so good news coming out of California. This is courtesy of one of our listeners named Aaron, who let us know that recently in California, Governor Jerry Brown's 2012 to 2013 state budget proposal is on the table for lawmakers to review. And included in his proposal is his recommendation to eliminate the requirement that high school students need to pass 2 years' worth of science classes in order to graduate. The governor's proposed budget refers to this as an unnecessary mandate. And those are his words, unnecessary mandate. He's looking to reduce it to a one-year requirement. And the governor's primary motivation is budgetary concerns. He says, because, well, we can't be wasting money on unnecessary mandates, like requiring that high school students pass 2 years' worth of science, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, California is in a budget crisis. I mean, you know, to put this into context for those who may not know, especially outside the U.S., you know, California is just swimming in debt. They have, rules in place that make it difficult to the governor doesn't even have that much power in terms of trying to rein in spending. There's a lot of mandatory spending because of just the way, you know, the state is run. So, they're desperate to find ways of cut spending. Not that, which doesn't justify what he's doing, but it does put it into context. I think this is exactly where you don't cut spending, and that is investment in infrastructure. And
well, it's the same thing as the last news item, Steve. It's a short-term game. It's bullshit.
Yeah.
And
well, investing in science education is investing in a very critical infrastructure of our country. That's not the kind of cutbacks that you make when you need, you know, short-term budgetary fixes. There should be 4 years of science education and science. Even two is a joke.
Yeah, we're having economic problems. Let's add more science to our curriculum so in the future the state isn't in this condition anymore.
Yeah, and it is funny that this is the second news item in a row about economic problems directly impacting science.
The governor said on his, because he ran for governor in 2010, his campaign website, he touted the following right on his website. Promoting more math and science through the State Board of Education and the Board of Trustees of the California State University System, we increased the graduation requirements to include 3 years of math and 2 years of science. To create local and state initiatives to increase school focus on science, history, and the humanities without reducing needed attention to math and English. And there was a special emphasis on teaching science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, STEM, as part of the broader curriculum. We need to strengthen STEM teaching and increase the number of STEM graduates. So this, you know, it's that hypocritical that he runs on that and then winds up doing something totally different. The other bad piece of news coming out of California recently, the report has found that only 22% of California's eighth graders have passed a national science standards test. And this ranks California as the fourth worst state in the nation for this test, behind Mississippi, Alabama, and the District of Columbia. This is the 2012 National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card, and it shows that too few students have the skills that could lead to careers in the fields regarding science. Not good.
I'm getting so sick of hearing this. I really, it blows my mind that they don't get the importance of this stuff. Like, what do we have to do to prove to them how drastically important it is to educate our populace?
I don't know.
What the hell do we have to
do? It's like that. This is a perennial problem with American politics, in that everyone running for office, whether governor or the president, it's like they push education as a big issue. I'm pro education, but then they don't put their money where their mouth is, right? If you're pro education, this is when you find out when there's a budget crunch. Where are you going to put your priority? Clearly, not in education. Especially science education, which everyone says, oh, STEM research, we have to support STEM research. It's an investment on the future. It's an investment in an infrastructure in our country. Great, then do it. You know, just talk about it. But it really isn't being done to the degree that it should. And I honestly do think that there should be 4 years of science in high school. I think even 2 years is not enough.
Thank God, yes.
Yeah. I mean, some schools will have the option of making it part of their curriculum. It just won't be necessarily
part of
it.
Means the poor schools won't get it. That's what that means. Yeah.
Exactly. That's the point, is that the ones that have the hardest time with the funding are going to suffer the worst. And those are the kids who can least afford to skimp on this level of education. And look, you take these two stories together. You've got eighth graders who are failing at the – I mean, 78% of them fail the National Science Standard Test, coming out of eighth grade and then going into high school, in which they're reducing the mandatory amount of classes. So it's coupled, right? I mean, it goes from bad to even worse when you just thought it couldn't get worse. But look, hey, we could always go somewhere else for our science
like
education.
Like South Korea,
South Korea, right? Yeah. The other piece of not so good news. Oh, if it was bad enough that creationists have their filthy mitts in our education system here at home, they're reaching into places around the world from which we don't normally regard as ripe targets for destroying science education. But South Korea is one of those places, unfortunately. And I'm quoting from the National Center for Science Education, who reports, a creationist campaign to remove references to evolution from high school biology textbooks in South Korea succeeded in May of 2012. According to a report in Nature, which came out just the other day, the Ministry of Education, Science, and Technology revealed that many of the publishers would produce revised editions that exclude examples of the evolution of the horse or of avian ancestor Archaeopteryx.
Archaeopteryx. So what happened is that the Committee to Revise Evolution in Textbooks, which is a creationist organization, petitioned the ministry to remove essentially as much evolution as they could from textbooks. The ministry then sent the proposal to the textbook publishers without any kind of review by biologists or scientists or the scientific community. And of course, the textbook companies are like, oh, we don't want to publish anything controversial. So they just agreed to it and they're just pulled out any mention of evolution. And so now, after the decision was made, it's being made public, and the science is like, hello, no one even asked us about this, about the science that in our textbooks. So it was terrible. The ministry is a total failure on their part, and I mean, they should have just told the creationists to go screw themselves, when they petitioned them in the first place. And if they have a process that they have to go through when they receive such petitions, then go through the process, but involve the scientific community. Instead, they just bypassed them and went straight to the textbook publishers.
Well, this is the problem, and this is what creationists and other evangelical Christians thrive on, is this, they spread. I think that often people in other countries look at the U.S. and shake their heads and wonder what went wrong. And they're not prepared to deal with the influx of evangelicals pushing their agenda in governments and in schools.
Yeah.
And so they're not equipped to deal with it, unfortunately. And I try to stress this point whenever I'm speaking, as I just did in Germany, for instance, where I talked about the anti-science laws the religious right is pushing in the U.S. And I made sure to point out that, it's not just happening in the U.S. And I showed them examples of, here's where our evangelicals have come and influenced, for instance, the European Union to influence their laws. They've done it in the U.K. in Parliament, and now they're doing it in South Korea. And I'm sorry to say, it's not a surprise. They saw an unguarded nation of children.
Yep.
And they moved in for the kill. And
their
they
mouths
got it.
Are salivating. And they,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
They're, yeah. they're predatory, you know?
Yeah, the South Korean scientific community was taken unawares. They don't have an infrastructure to deal with this. And now they got caught with their pants down, essentially. So now they're going to have to develop that infrastructure. They're going to have to get involved in defending and promoting good science education so that this kind of thing doesn't happen. They basically need a South Korean version of the National Center for Science Education, yeah. you know, like Eugenie Scott runs here in the U.S.
And they have to keep up with it, too. I mean,
yeah.
they can't
oh,
just
vigilance.
Do it once, knock it down
endless,
once. It's forever.
It takes endless vigilance. You know, unfortunately, the creationists have a single agenda. They can put all of their time and energy to it. For some reason, they're always well-funded, and they can tirelessly lobby the government and make mischief. You know, meanwhile, scientists and skeptics have to defend, you know, science and reason on 100 different fronts, and we have no funding, you know, or very little, only whatever, you know, our community donates to us. So it's tough, you know, it's tough to be vigilant.
Can I
about
just request you not
tr-
use make mischief because it makes them sound like lovable scamps.
Yeah, I know. They're not running around giving people hot foots.
They're,
I mean, they are corrupting and destroying education across the freaking globe. How pathetic does that
yeah.
sound? It's like I'm making it up. Across the globe. No, they're actually doing it across the globe.
Spanning the globe.
I like how they said that they tried to justify pulling mention of Archaeopteryx out of the textbooks. Well, there's no evidence that Archaeopteryx was actually an ancestor to modern birds. Look at all the feathered dinosaurs that are being discovered. So what? So you're using right. the discovery of the feathered dinosaurs, which is a massive confirmation of the evolution of dinosaurs into birds, as a reason for removing this evidence? Yeah, Archaeopteryx was not on the main line to modern birds. So what? It's an offshoot during a time of adaptive radiation of many different, you know, types of feathered dinosaurs. They definitely were somewhere in there, if not on the direct line. And who cares? It's completely irrelevant. It just shows their misunderstanding of the evidence for evolution. And I think they just don't care. It's a convenient argument for them to make. They don't
yeah,
care if it's really
anything.
Accurate or valid.
Total cherry picking.
Do we have any happy news stories?
We had the transit of Venus. That was a happy one. And we're going to
happy, joy.
Reverse the tone of our recent items with a quickie with Bob.
Ah, ooh. Good one.
Yes, thank you, Steve. This is your quickie with Bob. I call this quickie with Bob Vapor Movies. A scientist.
I think I've got the vapors.
The vapors. Scientists have devised a way to store images in a vapor of atoms. In fact, this is the first time that images have been stored at the same time and reliably played back in a non-solid medium. The scientists work for the Joint Quantum Institute. Wouldn't it be cool to work for a place called the Joint Quantum Institute?
Although there's a 50% chance that is total quackery. But this one's legitimate.
Why? Why? Why?
If you have the word quantum in your name, chances are 50-50 that you're either legitimate scientific organization or total quackery.
Or you
never know until you open the door.
Are you right?
Yeah.
Or you're in the Deepak Chopra realm.
Right.
Right,
plus they got a joint in there, too, so who knows what's going on. But this institute is a research partnership between the University of Maryland and the National Institute of Standards and Technology. So high level of confidence there. The quantum process that allows images to be stored like this is called gradient echo memory. Now, it's accomplished by finely tuning electric and magnetic fields along the 20-centimeter length of a special cell containing a vapor of rubidium atoms. Talk about cloud storage. Using this technique, they stored two movie frames, one of the letter N and one of the letter T. Now, I didn't say it was a long movie, but it consisted of two frames, so technically you could call this a movie. Unfortunately, you probably won't be watching a movie with this technology in the near future.
What?
But it appears very well suited, though, for storing and processing quantum information. And this is because this technology would be ideally suited to handle the very subtle issues that quantum computing requires, like coherence and environmental isolation. So for more fascinating details about
Gradient Echo Memory. Look for the May issue of Optics Express or do a Google News search for Atomic Vapor Movie, and you could read a lot more details about it. This has been your Quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you, too.
So we have to have an Academy Award category for Best Quantum Movie now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The nominees are the letter N, the letter T.
Yeah. I'll wait until they get 24 frames so we have a full second.
So, Rebecca, I think it's time to announce the winner of our Magnetic Words for Skeptics.
I think it is. Sorry we had to postpone it a little bit because of travel and such. You guys can tell me, you know, which is your favorite. And, of course, the winner will receive a free SGU t-shirt. And I'm happy to say that everyone whose poems I am about to read will receive a free download of our brand new iPad app, which is Word Magnets for Skeptics, sponsored by Skeptics Guide to the Universe, which you can find by going on iTunes and searching, and it costs like just a couple of bucks, and it has all of the same words as the word magnets, but you can play on your iPad. Okay, so here are the poems. Number one, I wish of all my billion creations, the technology to evolve angry nano robot monkeys was the worst threat.
I like that,
that
one.
Came from Joe Albeats. Next up, Alien, Bigfoot, and Creation Hoax, Why the Skeptic's Guide Will Think and Coax. To homeopathy, do not believe, debunked by evidence, proof from Steve. Rebecca kicks at science or fiction, smart like Evan, go vaccination. Of bird versus monkey, we like Perry, Jay always doubts fraud technology. With Nano Bob, they all face a billion, teaching medicine, physics, and evolution. That's from Jamie Hero, or that might be Jaime. Sorry if I might be Jaime or Jamie. I'm not sure.
I like that one.
That's good.
Yeah, that included a bit of rhyming, which I think is kind of impressive. Next up, they who ask about evidence and proof teach against every fiction. That's from Dustin Manning. Mm-hmm. Couple more. Homeopath actually debunks evolution with anecdote only, said psychic. Skeptics doubt this. Ghost of Darwin angry. That's from Mark
Darwin
Van.
Ghost getting angry.
Next up, vaccinate Bigfoot against alien nanoparticle robot abduction. Simple and sweet. From Brian Brophy.
Sums up the show.
Mm. Darwin monkey eats his creation. Joe Germani. And last up, there was a podcasting ghost, hoaxed the skeptic almost, but she did have doubt, said proof it's about, and offered the haunted some toast. That's from Scotty Harrison.
Scotty. Okay.
So that's all of them. So you guys weigh in. Let me know. I know which one is my favorite, but I'd like to hear from you guys.
I mean, the angry nano robot monkeys is, you know, deserves an honorable mention. But, I mean, the limerick, he's got to get the nod.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Exactly. You know, nano robot monkeys, what's not to love about that? But the limerick was just like, all right, that just flows so nicely.
It was perfectly paced. Very, very creative. That definitely, I think, will wind up being the winner here, although Jaime's is really good too. I really like that one as well. I'm splitting my vote between those two.
Split vote. Jay, did you weigh in?
Yeah, I don't disagree that the one that the guy wrote is hard, and he definitely put time into it, but I have to pick the one that goes vaccinate Bigfoot against alien nanoparticle robot abduction. Short, sweet, to the point, says it all.
That's a fine choice. That was Joe Germani's. No,
it's
I'm sorry. That
you
was
can
Brian
by.
Brophy's. My favorite, like most of you, was Scotty Harrison's The Limerick, because he actually like built words out of other letters and stuff just to get what he wanted. And, you know, it scanned well, which a lot of people can't write a limerick that scans, you know, just when they have a limitless supply of words. So, yeah, it scanned, it rhymed. Scotty Harrison. So
Scotty Do.
Congratulations, Scotty. We're going to send you a free t-shirt. I will send you an email and get your address and send it right off to you. Thanks to everyone who entered. Like I mentioned, everybody will get a free copy of our new iPad app, Word Magnets for Skeptics. And the rest of you can go onto the Apple store and you can buy it.
Well, Evan, I had to cover Who's That Noisy last week all by myself. It was lonely without you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I heard you did a very, very competent and adequate job. Thank you, Steve, for doing that. I was away, as you know, but now that I'm back, I'm going to go ahead and play for you last week's Who's That Noisy as a reminder. And here we go.
L. Ron Hubbard.
That's easy.
my first thought was a beating heart, but there was no. It was too regular.
What do you mean? It was too regular.
It didn't have the characteristic, thump thump of a heart. It was just like a. It was like half of a heartbeat. I don't know. It just it reminded me of a flowing liquid.
It reminded you of a beating heart, but there was something wrong about it.
Yes. Well, yeah, right. Or that's another way to look
at it.
Correct.
Yeah. That was the point. And a lot of people did guess, that it was a, the sound of a beating heart in some capacity. But, you had – what we were really looking for is what exactly is going on here? What condition is this heart in?
Asystole?
Right?
No.
What is it called? That's known as a pansystolic heart murmur.
Any medical student should be able to identify that.
And apparently a medical student did identify exactly – that it was a holosystolic murmur, also known as a pansystolic.
Yeah.
Are the two terms interchangeable, Steve?
Yeah.
Cyclosarin, C-Y-C-L-O-S-A-R-I-N, his first post on our message boards, and he says, sounds like oscillation of a heartbeat with systolic murmur, classically a pansystolic murmur. And he says, which would be due to mitral valve regurgitation or ventricular septal defect. Yeah, so this guy's, read a heart book or something like that. In any case, he was the first one to correctly guess exactly what that noisy was. So, well done. Thank you for playing.
Good job.
Cyclosarin.
Good job, yeah. It's impressive.
Well, on to the new one. Rebecca, I had you in mind when I came up with this week's noisy. So, little hint for you there.
Okay.
Here we go.
And what it is as your readers know, is that the sun is made of plasma. It's a fourth state of matter. So,
all right, that's it.
That's it?
That's all you need. Our email address is info@theskepticsguide.org, and our forums is sguforums.com. Go ahead, post your guess, give it your best shot, and good luck to all of you.
Thanks, Evan. All right, we're going to do one email this week. This one comes from Marv Zelkowitz from Columbia, Maryland, and Marv writes, Steve, I know that you know what peer review is, but I think you sometimes mislead your audience when you mention that some new idea has not yet gone through peer review as a way to validate the claims of the idea. Peer review is just the initial step in the validation process. It is a series of experts who review a paper to make sure that there is no blatant error or mistake in what has been written. Once a paper has gone through peer review and then is published, the real validation then begins as other scientists try to duplicate the results. Only after repeated cases of duplicating the results or of failed attempts to invalidate it does the claim start to have validity. Peer review does not help against collecting faulty data or downright fraud, and it is sometimes possible that the claim is not true even though it seems to have been validated. This last case is what pseudoscientists count on, that their claim is the one out of the thousands that will overturn established scientific principles, something that really happens. A discussion of this might make an interesting segment on the SGU. Obviously, I agree, or else I wouldn't be reading your email. I agree with everything Marv says, although I don't think that we've created that false impression on this show, because we have talked about this before. We do mention peer review, because peer review is what I would call a necessary but insufficient step in gaining scientific legitimacy. If you don't even get past the pre-publication peer review process, then there's probably something seriously wrong with your study or your paper. But once you are peer-reviewed, that's no guarantee that the results of the study are good, that the study is not the result of researcher bias or cherry-picking or even fraud, and it has to go through post-publication review, which includes, you know, the scientific community picking it apart. Just last week, we discussed the dark matter study where that was published, showing that there wasn't any local dark matter. And then after it was published, other scientists reanalyzed the data and said, nope, you made this error. And in fact, there is local dark matter. And we do that all the week. In fact, I frequently will say when discussing, like on science or fiction, discussing papers, I will frequently throw in the caveat. It's almost a reflex now that if this pans out or if this holds up, you know, once it goes through the meat grinder of scientific review, you know what I mean? So I think we're pretty good, actually, at not giving the impression that just because something is peer-reviewed, that the results are valid, correct, and legitimate.
And it was several years ago now, so, and it was rather brief, so maybe this listener missed it, but I do remember mentioning a few years ago that I went to see a talk by Fiona Godley, who's editor-in-chief of the British Medical Journal, in which she spent her entire talk lambasting peer review and talking about how insufficient it is for instance, catching fraud, and how she is in favor of an overhaul of peer review as a system for checking scientific accuracy. So, you know, this is a topic we've talked about before, yeah, but never really, not necessarily in depth and not in a while.
Yeah, I think we have to, it's one of those things we have to revisit every now and then, because it is, I agree, it is very core to what we talk about. So many times we talk about different studies, and it's good for people to know what it means to be peer-reviewed and the pre-publication process versus what happens to a study after it gets published. All right, well, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready this week?
Oh, yeah.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Scientists estimate that the number of undiscovered drugs is 10 to the 60th, or a million, billion, 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 billion. Item number two. An international team of scientists have published a paper in Nature finding that the world is rapidly approaching a tipping point of global ecological collapse. And item number three, biologists report on a recently discovered parasitic plant that transfers genes to its animal host in order to make it more hospitable. Bob, I don't believe you've gone first in a while.
Number of undiscovered drugs, 10 to the 60. Well, that's a huge goddamn number. Is that a sextillion?
It's not a Google.
Nope. It's a novem decillion.
Oh.
It's one common term in everyday use.
One of the boring ones.
Febtober.
10 to the 60. Yeah, that's gargantuan. But it depends. It depends how you define a drug, obviously. And, you know, there's so many combinations and permutations of all, you know, various elements and compounds and molecules. I mean, So I'm kind of like of two minds. It seems like a huge number, but I just think you can combine things in so many different ways that, yeah, maybe you can. It doesn't mean that there are good drugs, but crap. Let's see. International team of scientists, the world is rapidly approaching a tipping point, global ecological collapse. Yeah, I could see. I hope they're wrong, but considering all the changes going on throughout the world and all the various ecological niches. Yeah, sure. I could see them coming to that conclusion. It's not too out there as I see it. Let's see the third one. A parasitic plant that transfers genes to its animal host in order to make it more hospitable. Wow, that's cool. Wackier things have happened. So it's for me, it's between one and three.
I hope that's the headline.
Wacky things happened. It's a section of the news.
I'm going to say 10 to the 60 is just too damn high. I'll go with that one.
Okay.
Fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Bastard.
Well, 10 to the 60. It's a big number. It's not a Google, but it's a big number. I'll move on to the second one. The world is rapidly approaching a tipping point of global ecological collapse. It's a little broad. It's a little alarmist, perhaps.
I hope.
But that doesn't mean they didn't, you know, publish the paper. It's not. Doesn't mean that the paper is right.
It's peer review.
Oh, wait. You're right. So it must be right. The biologist, okay, the parasitic plant that transfers genes to its animal host in order to make it more hospitable. How does that transfer of genes happen? Ugh, if I knew more about genetics, this might make more sense to me. I'm leaning towards this one being the fiction. Something's missing there. I think that one's the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, for me, it's between the drugs one and the parasitic plant. Yeah, obviously, the world is rapidly approaching a tipping point of global ecological. Obviously, that's happening. So, yeah, no, that's fine. And the thing is, I can believe that there's a huge number of undiscovered drugs, mostly for the reason that Bob mentioned before he decided that this one was the fiction, which is that, you know, there's so many, like, molecules and compounds that you can put together and, you know, so many different ways. Sure, why not? I'm just going to, once again, trust you, Steve, that it's not actually a million, billion, 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 as opposed to
10 to the 61st power.
A million, billion, 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 billion. So for that reason, I'm going to go with the parasitic plant one as well. I don't get how that gene transfer happens. I feel like that one's the least likely, so I'm going to go with that one.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Yeah, all righty. No Jay?
Okay, that first one about the potential billions and billions and billions of undiscovered drugs, it's really hard for me to conceptualize a limit on how many variations there would be for different types of or different kinds of molecules and how they're constructed. I think they could get down into amazing detail on what a variation would be considered. And that's the hard part here, is what is the actual variation that you're talking about? At what level would you actually say one is a variant of the other? So that, coupled with the idea that they could make custom medication for people down, I think, to the DNA level, I've read things about them working on that. So sure, this one absolutely seems like it's possible, even though that number is incredibly huge. Taking the second one, you know, this one has the sound of a totally alarmist, you know, it's the world is rapidly approaching a tipping point of global ecological collapse. Yeah, it sounds incredibly scary and alarming and everything. However, you know, they don't actually say, when they say rapidly, what do they mean? Do they mean, you know, this year, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years? Depends on what your scale is. And then that last one about the parasitic plant transferring genes to the animal host, that sounds exactly like something freaky in nature that is going on right now. I don't really know if a plant's genes could communicate and interact with a mammal's genes or what's really going on there, but I just think that's freaky enough for it to exist. So as I review the three of these, I think, you know, I'm going to have to take the one about parasitic plant.
So you guys all accept that an international team of scientists have published a paper in Nature, a very prestigious peer-reviewed journal, finding that the world is rapidly approaching a tipping point of global ecological collapse, and that one is science.
Obviously.
Yeah, so this is 21 scientists from different disciplines around in different countries who analyzed changes to the planet's ecosystems that are happening. So we know from historical data that local environments, like, say, the North American environment, that local on that scale, can reach this climate tipping point or ecological tipping point where there's a rapid collapse of the existing ecosystem and transition to a new balance, right? A new system, which then can take up to about 1,000 years or so to establish itself. Once the system gets beyond a certain tipping point, they say it can't go back. The previous ecosystem is gone. And they say that, you know, the Earth doesn't remember its prior state. So there's really no way to get back to the way it was before. So it has to just go through to a new equilibrium, whatever that's going to be. And it's not necessarily a worse state than the previous one, although there, it is pretty disruptive in the transition, which could last like 1,000 years. But it certainly would be very disruptive to our civilization as we're kind of dependent on the current ecosystem.
A little.
Kind of.
Just for our food and our energy.
So it could be a problem. So they say that this could actually happen on a global scale, not just a local scale, because of the way energy is changing in the environment and because of the climate change, et cetera. The displacement of natural environments with agriculture and cities, that we are actually pretty close to the point where we are going to be past the point of no return, and the current ecosystem of the global ecosystem will collapse. They said the study concluded that it would be very likely to happen if we exceed the 50% mark in terms of wholesale transformation of the Earth's surface, so changing forest into wheat fields, something like that, or into cities. And right now we're at the 43% mark. So if we go from 43% where we are now past 50%, they predict that would be a point of no return for the planet's ecosystem. Let's go back to number one. Scientists estimate that the number of undiscovered drugs is 10 to the 60th power, or novemdecillion. Bob, you think this one is the fake. That number is just too high. The rest of you think this one is science. And this one is science. Sorry, Bob.
Wow.
Yep, these...
Wow.
The mighty have fallen.
Well.
So what the scientists said was they...
You're going to remember this the rest of your life.
They explored so-called chemical space. They used physical and chemical properties, the laws of physics and chemistry in order to calculate the number of possible small molecules that are in the size range where they could be used as a drug, as a potential drug. And they came up with the number of 10 to the 60th, possible different chemical small molecules that therefore could function as a drug. Obviously, not all of them would be useful drugs. Probably the vast majority of them won't be, but that's the potential number.
Which means
that biologists report on a recently discovered parasitic plant that transferred genes to its animal host in order to make it more hospitable is the fiction. That one is fiction. Not as far-fetched as you made it seem, however. There is so-called horizontal genes transfer. Do you guys remember we did a recent news item in which a slug was eating algae and getting the genes for photosynthesis from the algae, and it was actually working? So there's precedence for this, and this is based upon a real news item. I wasn't sure to make this one true or the fiction. Again, I've been having that problem recently. This one is it is a parasitic plant, and there is horizontal gene transfer between the host and the plant, but it's from the host to the plant, to the parasite, not the other way around, and it's one plant parasitizing another. So what they found was, there is a parasitic plant called the corpse flower found in Southeast Asia, and it attaches itself to host vines, mainly members of the grapevine family. And what researchers found is that the parasitic corpse flower had genes that were very similar to genes found in their hosts, more similar than could be accounted for by their evolutionary relationship. They're actually quite distantly related. And therefore, they concluded that the parasitic corpse flower had acquired those genes at some point in the past from the grapevine host. And that some of those genes may actually be functional. They're actually using the genes. They didn't just incorporate them into their DNA, which is very interesting. This is the first time that has been established, horizontal transfer of genes from host to parasite. There is a complicated relationship between hosts and parasites, including their genetic relationship. The study also discussed the fact that in other ways, other than just the transfer of genes, the parasitic corpse flower is evolving to genetically be more similar to its hosts, and they think that that is because it would make it a more successful as a parasite, better able to interface with the host. So the, I mean, the idea that I had is, if you can imagine if a parasite, rather than getting genes from the host, if it, let's say, inserted genes into the host so that the host would be better food for it. You know, it would produce chemicals that it needs to survive, et cetera, almost like a virus, you know, inserting genes to make something that it needs.
Fascinating.
Hmm.
So, Bob, rare week where you're the sole loser.
Loser.
Wow.
That's all right.
When you say it like that, it's...
Yeah,
that's what I'm going to
rub it in there, Steve.
Oof.
I do it once in a while, make everybody else feel good.
You're good that way.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Jay, you have a quote for me?
You're welcome.
I was looking for Ray Bradbury quotes, and Evan sent in a good one, and I actually am going to go with one that was sent in by the guy that sent in last week's quote, and that guy's name is Patrick McComb. Hope I'm pronouncing your name right, even after you sent in the way to say it correctly. I can't remember. So here's the quote. The best scientist is open to experience and begins with romance, the idea that anything is possible. Ray Bradbury!
Wait, doesn't that, the idea that anything is possible notion, contradict his distinction between fantasy novels and science fiction?
Indeed it does.
Mm-hmm.
So Joshy and I have been working further on the Skeptics Poker Tournament that's going to be at TAM this year. This is the first annual Skeptics Poker Tournament, and we really hope that everyone can join us. If you're interested, all you have to do is send us your name or all the names of the people that you're going to pre-register to skepticspoker@gmail.com. So please include the full name and the email address of each person that's registering. The game is Texas Hold'em. It has a $125 buy-in. Joshy is giving free lessons throughout the event. We're going to have some time slots that we're going to pick. The event starts at 11 p.m. on Saturday night, and I really hope you join us.
Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Shirley.
Good to be here.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.